TFM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is, once again, this season, even though he pretended to leave the ship and he's already back, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, during that little break there, I just have to ask you, whose bed have your boots been under?
Well, yeehaw, cowboy. It's good to be back. Howdy, Wranglers. It's so good to be back on the Enterprise here. And, man, my boots have been under a bed that's been less comfortable than normal. Especially camping on a cot, on a dilithium moon, full of dilithium. We're working hard here. Just trying not to get on the bad side of some Klingons. You know what I'm saying?
Sounds kind of like we got a Western going here, Matthew.
It's pretty much what's happening. It is interesting. Before we even dive into anything, I'm just thinking, this really has kind of brought back, I think, the Western feel that the original series had, wagon train to the stars. And I think, that's kind of fun to have that sense of adventure back. Star Trek, in many ways, I think, took a lot from those old serialized Westerns. So it's great to be back.
Absolutely. Well, we are looking forward to kicking off a new season of Strange New Worlds. And today we're discussing the first episode of season two, The Broken Circle. Here is a quick rundown of the story. Assuring Spock that he'll do fine commanding the Enterprise for 3 days while the ship is docked at Starbase 1, Captain Pike sets off to help Number 1, who has been arrested for concealing from Starfleet that she is a genetically enhanced Illyrian. Soon after Pike leaves, Uhura receives a distress call from La'an Noonien Singh. She says that she is on the planet Kajitar 4, and that troubling events are bubbling up that could threaten the security of the Federation. When Spock requests permission to investigate, Admiral April gives him an answer, and that answer is no. Spock, therefore, has no choice. He must steal the Enterprise. He is helped in his cunning plan by an inspector giving the ship a thorough rundown. Having grown bored of being almost immortal, the Lanthanite woman named Pelia wants a little adventure in her life. Maybe just a surprise or two. Once on Kajitar 4, the crew find La'an and help uncover and stop the plot of a syndicate called the Broken Circle, comprising ex-soldiers from both sides of the recent Federation-Klingon War. The group aims to restart the conflict so they can hike up prices and profit by selling the planet's rich dilithium deposits to both sides. Along the way, Spock experiences emotions. So Matthew, as I get towards the end of that little synopsis there, I was kind of picturing this taking place in an old West town where it's not dilithium, but you've got some people ganged up in a town. They've hatched a plan causing trouble for the locals. And then you need a sheriff to come in from outside and clean things up.
I mean, it does kind of sound like myself right now these days paying exorbitant prices for gasoline, So somebody's hiking up those prices. I don't know who they are, but apparently this just felt very familiar.
So this is one of those ripped from the headline stories, as it turns out, right?
It felt like that they were referencing some very, poignant things of what we're all going through these days. Uh-huh. I mean,
Star Trek would never do that, Matthew.
Oh, no. I mean, as we're recording this here in the Northwest, I mean, it's almost $4.50 a gallon for gas, wow, which is insane. So, the most interesting thing about this, Chris, and one of the things that I think both of you and I were thinking about was, being back in the saddle here, that we were left in a place where La'an had left to find this girl's parents. And then Una has been arrested. And I don't know if either of us necessarily thought that this would be the story we would tell here in the season two premiere. But I guess in some ways I kind of appreciate that one of these stories is going to continue a little bit and that the other story has been allowed to just kind of fix itself because, you know, I couldn't have imagined this show with La'an not being there for an extended period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think when we talked about that moment last season where she asks Pike to let her leave the ship for a while, we were wondering, where is she going to go? How long is she going to be gone? Are they going to follow her story in parallel while they've got this other stuff going on? And it didn't seem like it would fit the format of the show because although we do have, as we have in this episode with Una, with the Gorn conflict on the horizon, these types of things, we have these threads running through it, but they are really giving us these standalone shows and with a lot of diversity of style and genre. And so to have this other side story going on where they've got to follow one character on some side mission didn't seem like something they would do. And I think that the way that they have resolved it here works really well for the tone of the show. We don't need a long explanation. We just know that she left to go track down the girl. And once she found her and her parents, that mission's over. And it happens that something else comes up that reconnects her with the Enterprise crew. And near the end, when she's asked, you know, where are you going to go next? Just the look that she gives signals that probably next episode she'll be back on the Enterprise in her red uniform as head of security. And that'll be that.
Yeah, I think it makes sense to do this to, like you said, we already come into this episode and time has passed. You know, I mean, we get Uhura being made an ensign because of her work on the Enterprise. And so we know some time has passed. And of course, the Enterprise itself has been through inspections and, you know, upgrades and all those type of things. It seems like at Starbase One. And of course, we still have this lingering question of what's going to happen with Una's trial. And I thought it most interesting as well that this season starts where Pike is in the episode maybe 5 minutes and that he's traveling to go find someone who could apparently help in Una's trial. And whether or not he'll be successful, I think, is what it looks like, you know, the second episode may be building towards. And so, but that was a surprise for me because I didn't expect us to come back into the season and to just allow Pike to not be the main character that we're going to focus on here because he's kind of the point of the show in many ways. And yet, I think this show is doing a very good job of pulling from, you know, the Deep Space Nine style of storytelling, which is that you don't have to have the captain be the main character every week. And so that's a really nice thing to see here. And two, you know, you mentioned there's this looming threat that seems to be coming with the Gorn. And so this episode allows us to settle some disputes elsewhere that hopefully give the Federation and Starfleet command a maybe one front battle coming instead of possibly two. So it's interesting just how much this episode is able to do in 50 minutes, which is great. And I think it's really well done storytelling because it, like you said, it also creates an episode that you can just watch on its own and enjoy.
Right.
But as a part of the larger whole, it also fits very nicely.
Yeah, this is an episode you can just watch and enjoy, and you don't really need to connect it to what came before or after because you get enough explanation of what you need to know about Una. You don't really even need to know that La'an left the ship. She could have just been on that planet. And so, yeah, it wraps up into a nice package that's enough of a standalone that it feels like the more traditional Star Trek style of storytelling than what we've been getting in most of the modern Star Trek, air quotes there, because I guess it's all kind of modern, right? But anyway, talking about Pike, though, yeah, I like the fact that he's just there at the beginning and then he hands the episode over to everybody else and he leaves. What I think is interesting about it is that this show exists because of Anson Mount's charisma on screen in Discovery Season 2. And of course, what Ethan Peck did as Spock and Rebecca Romijn did as Number One played a part as well, but it was really Anson Mount's presence that took over that season. I mean, it even took it over to the point where even the idea of sharing command with Saru, which is brought up at the beginning, kind of fades away and it's the Pike show. So the point of that is that fans really wanted this show, Strange New Worlds, because of Anson Mount more than anything, I really feel. And yet, he's the lead of this show, but he doesn't act that way at all. He is very much part of an ensemble. We even saw in season one many times where he steps back from the spotlight and the rest of the crew shines. And it's something I really like about this show, and I love about how Anson Mount plays Pike and then how the writers are writing the characters and all, that they really do create this ensemble feel. And you've got a lead who seems very comfortable with not being the center of everything as the captain. And in that SFX article that we have talked about, not on this show, but we talked about it. Actually, no, it's not that one. There was a different SFX article we talked about on the Artificial Tango with Terry Metalis talking about Picard. But there was one in the most recent issue before the premiere of season two of Strange New Worlds where they did an interview with Akiva Goldsman. And he talked about the ensemble nature of the show. And he said that we don't try to service everybody all the time. We will kind of let people almost not be in an episode in order to dig deep into whoever is the centerpiece of this episode. And I think that you see that here. They've taken their captain and they've quickly moved him out, so he's not in the episode. They focused on Spock. I feel like this is primarily a Spock story. But what I also find interesting is that even though this is primarily a story about Spock's character growth, it's actually other characters, especially Mbenga and Chapel, who get the most screen time. So it's like they're like layers of ensemble writing going on here.
Yeah, no, I think it's smart of them to do this, and partly because, you know, you want, I think, all of these characters to be fully rounded. And, you know, again, that's very much a thing that I think Deep Space Nine did, right? It's a thing that I think Enterprise ended up doing, you know, especially with the three main characters very well. And I think this show is wanting you to be able to feel that feeling with not just its captain, but with these other characters as well. And I think, again, you know, the only character so far still that we aren't spending a ton of time with is Ortegas, which I'm sure we'll do in this season because that didn't happen in the first season. But I mean, you know,
but I feel like she got a lot of moments in this episode, even though they didn't dig into her background.
Right, right. I think that was the thing with her is she gets a lot of, like, I think humorous moments, but nothing that really gives us a sense of who she is as a person other than the fact that she has a, you know, a wicked sense of humor and is kind of a sarcastic. But I think, you know, dealing with the wider crew here instead of just the captain is a big deal. And you mentioned the fact that Mbenga and Chapel really get to shine in this episode. And part of that is that we deal with the fact that they were part of the Klingon War that had happened, whereas Pike and Una Chin and Spock were not. Mm-hmm. And so you get these characters on the Enterprise now who had to deal with that war. And you know, Mbenga even says that 100 million Federation citizens had died. Mm-hmm. And so we really deal with the fact that he has serious PTSD and war trauma from this and is still dealing with the anger issues that it comes up. And you also get the feeling as though Chapel has been able to find a way to deal with this, that it's not bothering her as much as it is Mbango, but they've gone through something that makes them very, very close, which I think this episode did such a great job of giving us that sense that these characters are very close characters. There's nothing romantic between them, but they have been bonded by war in a way that, you know, these other characters on the Enterprise haven't necessarily, because they went through it together. And so I really enjoyed dealing with that. I mean, you know, obviously too, watching them get to kick some serious Klingon ass, because Mbenga and Chapel have come up with this serum that basically makes them super people, allowing to be able to fight Klingons, which, you know, again, was something I thought was interesting. It makes sense. You know, humans fighting Klingons, they're twice our strength. So you would need something like that. All of these things that they do with these two characters alone, I think are really fascinating. And it really made this episode very interesting to me, because it was unexpected. I was not expecting to learn this about these two characters and spend the time with them the way we did, because this is not where I was expecting the episode to go with where we left off. But I'm very glad that we got the opportunity to spend with these two characters like this. And I am, at this point, I'm so much more invested now, even than I was before, in them, because, you know, now that Mbenga's daughter and that storyline is finished, now we've got another story to deal with where his dark side and Chapel knowing about that and everything is, I think, really, really a great place to be able to go. It's a good trajectory of storylines now for these two characters specifically.
Well, also learning that he has this trauma from the war, and looking at how calm and nurturing he is generally as a character, and everything he was trying to do to save his daughter, how he interacted with her, but also how he interacts with the rest of the crew. He's very much a calming presence. I feel that way when I watch him. And to know that he's dealing with all of this turmoil inside and this trauma inside really adds a lot of depth to the character. And it raises some interesting issues too about what happened during the war, because I got the impression that this stimulant is something that he had used repeatedly during the war. And
yes.
Chapel asks him, do you really want to do this again? Do you really want to go back there again? And that raises, if we talk about social commentary elements in Star Trek, this kind of touches on, well, this episode touches on a lot of the aspects of war and how war can be used to profit off of people, how it damages people, because we've got the whole plot here by the Broken Circle Syndicate to restart the war so they can hike up the dilithium prices. But here it suggests that maybe not officially sanctioned by Starfleet, but there may have been the use of stimulants during the war on Federation officers who were fighting in order to allow them to actually fight Klingons. And you know that has to have a very lasting impact on the body. And that's something that in the real world, you know, soldiers in war may be drugged, may be on stimulants. And so that's an element of realism in here for sure.
Well, and what's interesting is the way in which this mirrors what Spock is going through, right? There is this thing in Spock that has been broken because he allowed his anger out. There's this thing in Mbenga that has been kind of broken because of the war. And that's when Chapel says, do you want to go back there again? It's that idea of opening that door back up to a dark place that you've been and you're trying to recover from. So I think the best part about the episode, it really to me, is the way in which these pieces are really connecting to one another and allowing you to be able to experience through multiple characters similar things happening and how they're going to deal with it. And it's fascinating to me then, too, because you're putting Chapel in the middle of these two men, right, of M'Benga and Spock, who have both suffered a kind of emotional trauma. And she it seems to be a linchpin in helping them be able to deal with it. You know, for her and Spock, of course, it's very different because they're in love with one another and they don't want to admit it. But with M'Benga, you know, it's more of she is the person in arms who bonded together because of their experiences. And she understands where he's been because she's been there herself. And that allows him to be able to have this person that can speak into his life. You know, and so I really like the dynamics that we're setting up here. And you know, if we're calling out things that I think the season is already doing well, is it is allowing us to build depth between the characters and their relationships together that, again, go beyond just the captain and a couple of other people and their relationship to the captain. This is about the relationships of the crew and their interrelationships with one another. And I think that's the thing that, again, if we want to call out, I don't know if any other series has really ever done that as well as Deep Space Nine had done, right? And this show seems to be working very diligently to do that. It's obviously something that we talked a lot about, I think, within, you know, season three of Picard, where you were able to pull on all of those relationships from the Next Generation and really amplify them in a way that series never really did, because we didn't really get into the nitty gritty of these relationships. This show, we're doing that. And I think that makes this really interesting because it's allowing us to explore the human condition, but do it in Star Trek, you know, and that's what Star Trek was really all about. It's right. What TOS was doing such a good job of with its relationships between Spock, Kirk, and McCoy. This show is allowing us to do that, but with more of the characters involved in that. And that's great because you don't want characters to just be there and not really get much to do. That's always frustrating. For the audience and for, you know, any actor involved in that. And so love the fact that, you know, here, M'Benga and Chapel are such a hallmark of this episode. And again, it's one of those things where I'm so excited to see where we go, especially with just these two characters and their relationship and what they're going through and how that's going to play out, especially since, and we haven't mentioned this yet, but you know, because of what's going on with Chapel and Spock, Chapel is actually thinking of maybe leaving the Enterprise for a couple of months on a fellowship just to get away, because I think she's feeling the weight of the fact that, you know, she doesn't know what to do with this thing with Spock. So maybe get away will help. And that's a whole other storyline that will, who knows what's going to happen there. Will she leave? Will she stay? You know. Shall I stay or should I go now?
That's exactly, you know? What just popped into my head when you said that. Yeah. Yeah. No, Chapel's like, I'm in love with Spock, but it's not going anywhere. So I think I'll go spend a few months on his home world.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's going to help. Yeah.
That won't remind me of things at all. No. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, again, too, you know, we just to kind of bring this back a little bit at. We had all the stuff that was going on with Cybok and stuff being introduced right? in the end of the season, you know, those last few episodes. And so this season has so many things to be able to build upon. But I liked that what they built upon in this episode was really more character driven than it was necessarily just the big overarching plot elements. Those came organically through the character work, which is always a better way to tell a story.
Yeah.
Forget about trying to make sure you just get big plot points in. Focus on characters and work that in as it comes. And they did a great job, I think, in this episode of that.
So you bring up the Cybok thing. So are you suggesting that Chapel is going to leave the Enterprise, go to Vulcan for a few months, and fall in love with Spock's half-brother, and it's going to become kind of like a soap opera?
I don't think we're going to turn this into a weird Three's Company, Chris. So thank God about that. But no, I was actually thinking with her possibly going to Vulcan that that actually might come about in the sense that
she might encounter Cybok.
But also it led me to the thought of, would that be another thing where Chapel is kind of placed in danger because Cybok knows about her friendship or, you know, whatever with Spock somehow. And, you know, anyway, all that stuff could happen, but that's just pure speculation.
Yeah. Well, of course, T'Pring is there and she knows all about it and has reason to be jealous. Yep. So, yeah, a lot of stuff could happen there. I wanted to ask you if this crossed your mind as we're talking about Mabinga and Chapel before we move on. When they inject themselves with the stimulant, because we don't really know what it is at that point, we just see them do the injection. Did you think that they might transform their appearance into that of Klingons? Because I was thinking back to the very first episode of this series when they did the injections so they could go down to Kylie 279 and rescue Una and look like the locals. And then knowing that historically we've had Starfleet officers change their appearance to be Klingon, notably on Deep Space Nine, I thought that they might be doing that. And then when they zoom in on Mabinga's eyes, I thought, oh, maybe they're doing a transformation and they're going to pull back. And of course, that didn't happen. And then I had the crazy thought of, maybe they're just showing them as being themselves to us so that we realize it's them, but the Klingons are seeing Klingons. And then I told myself, as Una would say, you're being ridiculous, Chris.
Yeah, no, I actually thought a few of those things myself, not all of them that you did, but I did wonder if they were going to transform into Klingons. And then it turning out to be this kung fu stimulant. And of course, that raises so many more questions that we don't get answered in the episode. But I'm looking forward to hopefully us maybe digging into more of this backstory with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about Spock himself, because I mentioned earlier that I feel, although he's not the centerpiece of the action per se, the arc in this story is very much from the beginning when Pike tells him that I'm going to be gone for 3 days and you're going to be in command of the Enterprise. And Spock seems very uncomfortable with that idea. And as the episode goes on, he hatches the plan to steal the Enterprise. And then he goes against Admiral April's orders. He does all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect from Spock or from a Vulcan. He even comes up with his thing when he wants the ship to go now. But at the end, you feel like you see a Spock that feels a little bit lighter. Like, I think he's confused by the emotions, but he has let them out. He's acted on them. And you see a difference in the character just from the start of the episode to the end of the episode. And so, as you've already mentioned a bit earlier, it feels like the season may be about this transformation of Spock. But what I find interesting about it is that we know where Spock ends up in the original series, in the motion picture, up until his death in The Wrath of Khan, and then the resurrection and what he goes through again. So we know all this stuff about the character, and so it's going to be interesting to see how they take him through some kind of journey that's interesting to us as a viewer and makes him an interesting character, but still brings him back to that Spock that we know ultimately has to be there.
Yeah, I think that's something that we're going to talk a little bit more about later, and as a direct bearing on how I feel about the storyline. But to me, it's very interesting because the moment I saw the episode the first time, this very much felt like T'Pol's journey. When she had the Trillium D addiction, where she had wanted to be able to access those emotions that she had had during that experience, and it damaged her neural pathways and meant that dealing with emotions was going to be much more difficult for her to be able to suppress if she would ever be able to really do that again. And I think it's interesting here that we basically have done the same thing with Spock in the sense that we broke a Vulcan and now we're putting the pieces back together again. And it's a little bit like Humpty Dumpty. Will we be able to put them back together again? We don't know. And I think that's really fascinating here with this character. And it allows them to, I think, you know, they're very much playing with the idea that the Spock you see in the cage and in Where No Man Has Gone Before is a little bit different of a character. You know, I mean, we always reference shouty Spock. And I think that's the place that we're going in the sense that they feel like they have this wiggle room to be able to play with this character because they weren't set until a couple of episodes into the original series. And so I think that's what they're playing with. And I do think it makes for an interesting journey then with the character. And I think, like Enterprise, it's about exploring Vulcans in a new and interesting way instead of them just kind of being this emotionless race. No, they're actually a race with full range of emotions that are much more volatile than we have. And so being able to play with that with Spock makes it very interesting. So I don't really necessarily have an issue with them doing this at all. I think it's worth doing. And I think it goes with how they're really kind of playing around with canon.
Mm-hmm. Playing around with canon is a good way of putting what they're doing, which we'll talk about shortly. As for Spock, I feel like it's an appropriate way. Well, first of all, if you just made him the traditional buttoned up Vulcan that can never lie and doesn't show emotions, the show would be pretty boring. So for anyone who feels that they shouldn't be doing this with Spock because it's out of character, let's remember that they're writing a TV show and it wouldn't be very interesting if they didn't do something with the character. But I think it's a good way of portraying a young Spock because as we get older, as people, we change and we are hopefully wiser. We have a lot more experience. We maybe don't react the same way to things that we would have when we were younger. And you see that in the older Spock, I think, that we see later on, who is always trying to, and Leonard Nimoy did a good job of this, I think, even in the original series, of portraying a Vulcan who, you know, under the surface, there's this little bit of struggle with his human side, and that there is this emotion there. And so here we're seeing a more youthful Spock who, because of what happened with the encounter with the Gorn last season, has had the cap taken off of his emotions a bit, and he's having to deal with those. You mentioned the way that happened to T'Pol because of the Trillium D, where the cap was taken off of the emotions. And so I think that this is a fine and appropriate way to portray a young Spock. And I also think that it builds pretty well off of the Spock that we saw in Discovery, who was even more youthful and was affected by the storyline of that season and what happened to him and what happened to his sister. And that led us into this show, which is something else we need to talk about, that season led us into this show. But anyway, my rambling about Spock is that I think that this was a really nice portrayal of him. And you've mentioned you were surprised that the story went this way in the premiere because we had the dangling things with La'an and Una, with Cybok, with Kirk. There's so many things from the end of last season where they could have gone and yet they went in this direction. But I think focusing the first story of the season on Spock was a great idea because of all the characters in Star Trek, Spock might be the best known. If you go out on the street to anyone who isn't a Star Trek fan, they all know who Spock is. everybody knows who Spock is, and everybody knows who Klingons are. And the Klingons play a big role in this episode as well. First appearance in Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, I think that this also, it's interesting how this helps explain a little bit of why Kirk and Spock are going to work so well together. Because here we see Spock being willing to do the right thing, regardless of the cost to his career or what is easy, which is a very Kirk thing to do. That was an interesting thing to be able to, you know, portray about this character here when he's put into command of the Enterprise. You know, it's a big thing that he does in stealing the Enterprise so that he can go and help La'an.
But don't you love how that parallels Kirk stealing the Enterprise to go help Spock later?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think this is the thing that we're connecting this character in that way, and I think it's good, but it does show that Spock very much has an understanding of what is right and what is wrong, and he's willing to stick to that regardless of how difficult that is to do, which is, I think, also the conundrum that he feels with the way he feels about Chapel. And, of course, his promise to T'Pring, and that's what's causing this friction in him. And the fact that he has to go to M'Benga, and M'Benga gives him, his harp to allow him to be able to work out his emotions through music. Again, even by the end of the episode, we still haven't resolved any of this. Spock is still very much kind of stuck in between two people. And I think he's stuck between honor and his feelings of love for Chapel that he can't explain and did not expect. And so that's going to be an interesting story then to see how he handles that. I can't even say watching the show that I know what's going to happen, because I think, you know, we can actually ask the question then, you know, with what this show is doing with canon, and they specifically even mentioned in that article that you referenced there, they know that they're placing characters where they probably shouldn't be, and they're moving things around. And so to me, which is fine, because I've just put it in my brain that this doesn't really have to jive with anything else. This is Discovery and this are very much in its own universe. And I think the sooner that we accept that, the better we can enjoy the shows for what they are. I don't think that they're really necessarily trying to play super nice with canon. They're playing with canon as much as they want to. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to do anything extraneous where they're just going to destroy it. But I don't think they feel completely beholden to it either. And I think that's probably a better place to go, in much the same way that the Kelvin timeline specifically was meant to be able to allow you to tell stories with these characters without necessarily having to do the exact same thing, which, you know, again, I don't have a problem with.
Well, the Kelvin timeline comparison is an interesting one, because the Kelvin timeline was an intentional reboot of the timeline to allow Paramount to make movies when they didn't have the rights to the television property and they wanted to go in a different direction, right? So they needed to split. But the thing there is that it was very intentional that, hey, this is a different timeline. This is how things could have unfolded for these characters if history had been different. Whereas this is positioned to be part of the prime timeline and to fill in the back history that we don't know about. And yet, Akiva Goldsman very openly admits, as you said, that they know they're playing around with canon. They know that they're doing these things. And he told SFX that, yes, it's complicated. I think it's fun if you like it, right? I think if you don't like it, it's probably horrific. Part of what's interesting is we're interpolating history. There's pieces that are dark that we're filling in. So for me, because I like adding texture to the Star Trek universe, I am fine, as you are, with them doing these things with these characters. You know, Uhura being on the Enterprise at this point. that's fine. We don't know of her being on the Enterprise with Pike, but we also don't know that she wasn't. So it's fine that she's there. The Chapel Spock thing, especially, it's entirely possible, and we may have said this last season on Saddle Up, but it's entirely possible that the two of them get together and then grow apart. And by the time we see them in the original series, Spock's emotions are much more concealed again, and maybe Chapel still has some longing for him, and Spock just, you know, the romance bug is gone from him completely at that point, so he doesn't pay any attention to her. It's entirely possible that there's this whole backstory between them, and I don't think that it breaks what we know of the two characters in the original series.
Yeah, I like to, in all honesty, I saw this, I think, on Twitter, and I thought it was genius. To me, that Enterprise Temporal Cold War created splinter timelines, and this is just one of them.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, Discovery does not fit in canon whatsoever, and you will never convince me that it does. It makes no sense. And therefore, this taking place in that same timeline with Discovery, it can't fit within canon. It doesn't work. Mainly, too, even just the way that the Enterprise itself looks and feels and the technology that's used is completely different than what we saw in TOS. So, but again, I don't have an issue with it because, like Goldsman said, I like what they're doing here. I think it's smart and fun, and the characters are enjoyable, and the stories are interesting. And so just own up to the fact, and I think he almost did basically in there. It's like, yeah, we're basically breaking canon, but, you know, as long as you like it, who cares? And I think what they realized is that if you stick close enough to it, people are going to enjoy it. You know, I think Discovery was just such a divergent type of series, and that they realized it was better to have them in the 32nd century. But what we're doing with Pike and his crew feels close enough to the thing we loved, but again, it's like the Kelvin timeline. We're allowing you to be able to then do whatever you want, but still be in a familiar universe and a familiar time. And so, to me, I like this show. I think it does it well, but I'm not going to pretend like I have to make this fit with, you know, what we would consider the prime timeline. I mean, especially with new characters being introduced like Pellia and the Lathanites, which we've never heard of, and the idea that there's going to be a Gorn War, which we've never heard of.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Again, it doesn't bother me.
Well, Matthew, I mean, for all I know, you might be a Lathanite because they live amongst us until the 22nd century, you know, undetected. So you could be one and I don't even know it. I'd have no way to know.
It's true. It's true.
Not until you come out to Amanda Grayson. So.
Well, you know, I'm just waiting. Spock's mom seems like an understanding person. So, I think the beauty of this is that, and I think the genius of Strange New Worlds is that they found a way to be able to make people accept this without having to really ask these questions, because it's close enough that it works. And so I applaud them for doing that. And I think, honestly, this is just a really smart thing to do anyway.
So our listener, Mark Rodriguez, who I've mentioned on maybe on Artificial Tango before, but he sent me a message, a DM, after he watched this episode, but before I had, so I didn't read it right away. He mentioned some of these things, though, that he loves the show, but it bugs him that they flirt with canon so much and they introduce things like a war with the Gorn or the technology or characters they bring in like T'Pring and so forth. And, you know, I think it does echo what a lot of fans maybe increasingly feel about the show, whereas at the beginning of the first season, we all fell in love with it because coming off of Discovery, it really felt like this incredible effort to make it feel like the original series and Star Trek again. But the technology, of course, has to be updated. I personally wouldn't want to watch the show if they slavishly recreated the bridge of the Enterprise and they put gumdrop buttons everywhere, and it just wouldn't feel right to me. The way I look at things like that is that we're being told stories, and if you read a book, you use your own imagination to visualize the environment, visualize the ships and whatever is in the story. And I think that it can be helpful to approach Star Trek in that way to some extent, because as you said, this is close enough to what we know and love that we can feel like it fits well enough that we can just enjoy the stories. We're not distracted by some radically different creative take on the universe that makes it feel like it isn't Star Trek. And when I think back to the original series aesthetics, of course they were what they were because the show was being made in the 1960s. But I also think about how we've seen in a few Star Trek episodes where there have been books on the shelf with the titles of original series episodes. They had them in Travis's quarters on the Horizon and Enterprise. And I believe that George O had some, if I remember correctly, in her ready room at the beginning of Discovery. But I imagine that those original series episodes, we were being told these stories about something that had happened. And that's how the storyteller was visualizing for us what had happened. It doesn't necessarily mean that the ship and everything had to look exactly the way it did on the screen. And here we're being told stories by a different storyteller, and it's being visualized somewhat differently, but still close enough that it feels like the familiar universe.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think it was Metallus who was talking about season three of Picard and the idea that Star Trek basically is historical fiction. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I think this is the reason why you either need to do kind of what they're doing with Strange New Worlds, or you need to do what they did with Picard, which is find a way to do what you loved, and then you have the ability, because time has passed, to be able to update things, right? And it just feels natural. And I think that's the thing that makes more sense. And so, I think by allowing us to be inside a universe where Discovery and Strange New Worlds exists and doesn't necessarily jive with the rest of everything we knew from Star Trek, again, it's fine. I don't think we need, because like you said, we're just telling stories. And so as long as the stories work, that's what's important. And so far, the stories are working because the characters are working. And it does, again, feel close enough. And so, you know, and I think one of the things, you know, we got Klingons that look and feel like the Klingons that we're familiar with from the 24th century. But, you know, what's interesting here, of course, these Klingons don't necessarily look like the Klingons that we remember from the original series. So, you know, and
no, they feel like motion picture Klingons.
Right.
The ridges, it feels like they're going for that aesthetic, because later on in the Next Generation and in DS9, you get into how the ridges, the shape of the ridges have to do with the houses and so forth.
Right.
But here it's more like the motion picture Klingon aesthetic.
Yeah, which again, you know, I think it's great to have the Klingons, you know, look and feel like what we remembered them more so. Obviously, the makeup is updated and I think looks really good. You've got some Klingons here that, you know, too, we're not dealing with Klingon warriors that as we knew them even in the 24th century, right? You've got some privateers here. And then we saw a Klingon military officer and he felt very familiar. And so I think all of that was wonderful and created some nice consistency, and instead of unlike Discovery where you're trying to completely redesign the wheel for no good reason. This was amazing. You know, the D7 looked fantastic.
Yeah.
I also thought, though, this story, of course, feels very familiar because we've got Klingon and Federation members working together to create a war, which is exactly what happens in the undiscovered country. So
it all comes back to the undiscovered country, Matthew.
It always does. It always does. That and a Klingon proverb must be very close to the Ferengi proverb, which is war is good for business.
Exactly. While we're talking about this, I want to touch on one more thing because it's mentioned by Goldsman in this SFX article about the timeline and how all this stuff fits together. And it's something that came up last season on Saddle Up, and it's really interesting to me, and it also connects to what I said earlier about Spock's character growth and how this is an outshoot of what happened on Discovery Season 2. But at any rate, when we got to the end of our discussions last season, a few listeners brought up the fact that you had been under the impression that this show is pre-Cage, before the Cage, when it should be post-Cage because it's a spinoff of Discovery, and in Discovery Season 2, they go back to Talos 4 after the events of the Cage. However, I've always felt that what we're being given in terms of character and story, except for the flashbacks with Pike, that this show feels pre-Cage. And in this SFX article, it became very clear that Akiva Goldsman himself is not clear in his mind where this show is on the timeline, because he specifically tells them, when it was brought up that the show is far enough away for canon not to loom large in the plans they have for Strange New Worlds. And he said, at a certain point, we have to hit the Cage and where no man has gone before. And this allows them to have Spock move up and down the emotional scale, like you and I have been talking about, before becoming fully logical. And then he says, we don't really worry about it hitting TOS, but we're thoughtful in the same way that we're thoughtful of Pike's journey and where he has to go and how that works. So it seems that in his mind, he's viewing the show as being all the background before the Cage, although he mentions the Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before as if those two episodes fit together. They are the two pilots, but time-wise, in history, they're apart because you have Kirk on the Enterprise now, so there seems to be some confusion there in his mind about that. But what I just found interesting was that the showrunner himself is also kind of in muddy waters about where all these stories are taking place in relation to the Cage. And that, I think, maybe it plays into your comment earlier about maybe this is an alternate timeline that just feels a lot closer to ours than some of the other ones that we've seen, even though I know it's not their intention for it to be an alternate timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're absolutely correct. You know, him calling that out, and I think that's the thing about this. Like, it's not a big deal if that's the case, if it takes place before the Cage or after the Cage or whatever. But again, that's part of this whole thing of them playing with canon. They don't really know where they are or what they're doing. They're just telling stories. And I think, I almost wish, because I think it would be easier for everyone if they would just come out and be like, yeah, we're in an alternate timeline. Yeah. And, well, you know, who cares?
Yeah. But I know that in their minds, they're not. See, that's the thing. Like, they are writing stories that they feel are filling in the back history of the prime timeline that we know. But by playing around with this, playing around with the characters and all the way that they're doing, makes us question that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I didn't mention there that he said, this was the big one, actually. The whole reason that came up last season and someone wrote to us and said, hey, you guys think this is pre-Cage is because we were talking about Una. I remember now, we were talking about Una and the fact that, of course, she's going to be exonerated. She's going to be okay because she has to be there. You said she has to be there in the cage. And in this article, Goldsman says, well, here's the truth. We all know that number one is on Pike's Enterprise for the cage, right? So yes, thankfully, Rebecca remains on our show. So you can be sure that at a certain point, either in the first episode or in the third season or whatever, she would be returned to her rank and role because we know that's where she ends up. So he's leading exactly up to the same thing that you had said last season about, well, we know she's there in the cage, and that's what's going on in the mind of the showrunner. So very muddy waters in terms of where this is on the timeline.
Which, I think is proof positive to me that it's just easier for them to admit that they are not in the prime timeline, because then they can do things differently. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. So, the fact that we have the Klingons here and they look different is great. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, too, one of the things that they're also doing in the series, which is a lot of fun, is taking a lot of interesting style choices, whether it's the way they're filming the episodes with close-ups, slow motion, all of those kind of things, playing around with camera angles. They're also enjoying referencing things that we all know very much, like the Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Lon is drinking a Klingon under the table, just mm-hmm. like Marion in that movie. So, I think what's clear to me is that the show is having fun, and that the writers are having fun, the actors are having fun, and I think that's the thing that makes this... Mm-hmm. Regardless of the canon conversation, which I don't think really matters very much because people are having fun with the show. I think that this is why mm-hmm. that discussion is much different than it was with Discovery, because I think a lot of people watched that show and did not have as much fun, and therefore a lot of other things mm-hmm. became accentuated. Their frustrations became accentuated with that show. This show is doing such a good job with its style choices that people are enjoying it enough to not necessarily really care, I think, so much about these big questions. And maybe, again, that's where my attitude is. Like, I don't care because I'm enjoying it. But it's another thing to which I'm having my wife watch through Star Trek chronologically. Once we finish Enterprise, I'm not going to have mm-hmm. her watch Strange New Worlds, because it would just be confusing for her because of the way it doesn't necessarily really jive with all the stuff we're going to see in TOS. So we might come back to it after we watch all the other shows, because then she'll have a broader context. But for those of us in the know, or anybody maybe just coming to this completely brand new without any mm-hmm. context, those are the two places you need to have it, I think. Either no context or all the context.
Yeah. In thinking about this, I was thinking about how the question is, when you're dealing with a franchise and a universe like Star Trek that's been around for so long, how slavish do the creators need to be to everything that came before? And how much latitude should they be given to create something new? And in that SFX article, Goldsman called it, he said they're thoughtful but not slavish. And I thought that was a very interesting way to look at all of this, because as a creative, I really appreciate that idea that, yes, you do need to be thoughtful. If you're presented with two options and both of them work, generally, I think you want to choose the one that keeps you closer to what's familiar instead of going down a greatly divergent path. So that's being thoughtful. But if you have two choices and one of them is far more interesting, I don't think you should be slavish to what came before just for the sake of making sure that fans don't get upset because you changed something.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And I think that's why, for the most part, Strange New Worlds is working for most people.
Yeah. So what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one?
I feel like this is a really fun episode, and I really enjoyed where we went. You know, it was surprising, but I think we did a great job of setting up the rest of the season. There's a lot of little threads here of things and places it feels like we might go. And I can't wait to make the season go, you know? And
I want the season to go now.
Exactly, now. I'm going to give this 4.5 out of 5 Kung Fu juicers, because I think it's a really good episode. I think that's a really strong episode, and I think the show is continuing on a good trajectory from where we left off last season. So I nothing better than coming out of the premiere and being like, oh man, I can't wait for the rest of the season.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it was a great start to the season. I love that they started the season in an unexpected way, not just picking up the storylines that were dangling and making that the centerpiece of this first story, giving all the characters things to do, including Mitchell, who got to go and initiate a simulated breach of the warp core. And I'm very curious to see how this new character of Pelia works out on the show. She seems very interesting. She's quite well known for Wicked and I think The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is a comedy. So she has a lot of range, and I think she really showed it here. And being an alien gives that character and that accent, that voice and all that she's playing up there a lot of legs, I think. So it's going to be fun. But yeah, there are tons of other things about this episode that I could talk about. But I think we touched on all the big points, and I'm going to give it actually my rating, which I had thought about before recording, turns out to be very similar to yours, but I'm going to keep it because I think it's only appropriate as co-hosts that we both have the same energy level to fight our way through recordings. And so I'm going to give it 8 performance enhancing injections, but I will say that I like your name for them much better. Kung Fu Juicers. All right. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on The Broken Circle. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it all works. But if you're not, when you join, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. It's a closed group just for listeners. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. And so please do answer those questions. Let us know where you heard about it and agree to the rules of the forum. And to find it, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. It should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference, and you'll find it there. And you'll see a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can leave your comments there for Matthew, me, and fellow listeners right there on the timeline. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose Saddle Up, and that will mosey its way right over to us by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not feeling your heart rate rise when Nurse Chapel walks into the room, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, when that is not happening, you can find me all over the place under the moniker MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero. You can also find me, of course, here in the network in the 602 Club, talking about all those fandoms outside of Star Trek we love, then doing literary treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek, The Orb with you, Chris, as we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Warp 5 about Star Trek Enterprise, and then we've also got The Artificial Tango talking about Star Trek Picard. And then you'll find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Owl Post. Did that with Dre Kaufman, and we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series one chapter at a time. You'll also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills talking about Star Wars. But, you know, Chris, when you're not trying to find your way to some more blood wine, where can people find you?
I'm smart enough. I can drink a lot, but I'm smart enough not to get into a drinking contest with La'an. I can tell you that.
Very smart. Very smart.
But you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you. As you mentioned, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time, and you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog. You can also find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active, but you can find me all over the place. And I'm also on Mastodon, Trekkies.social instance, if you are there on the Elephant app. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without everyone who is supporting us now. So thank you so very, very much. We appreciate it greatly. Well, Matthew, I am looking forward to next week when we find out what's going to happen. I'm predicting that Una's probably going to be coming back, but we'll see.
Well, Chris, I hope so. So I want this episode to come now.